So I'm very pleased this afternoon to join the Virginia Innocence Project volunteers and our Innocence Project Clinic in welcoming Beverly Monroe, who has graciously agreed to come and share what has to be the worst thing you can ever imagine happening to anyone happening. As you know, at least the people in my clinic, because you read the opinion, right? Beverly was wrongfully convicted of a murder and served too much time before being exonerated and released. There's a lot of ways in which Beverly stands for all the things that happened in all the wrongful conviction cases that we read about. There was some withholding, considerable withholding of exculpatory information. There were jailhouse informants. There were coerced confessions. And those things, we are learning in our clinic at least, happen in most of the cases where a wrongful conviction is later established. But Beverly stands for another principle too, which is she's a reminder to people like ourselves that this really can happen to anybody. I think that most of us convince ourselves that the system is fine because you can't imagine spending your days worrying that this might be the day you get framed for something you didn't do. Beverly, in a lot of ways, was exactly the opposite of anyone you ever thought would be accused of anything. And I bet most people in this room would be more likely to be accused of something than Beverly. Or at least maybe I would. She was educated. She had a wonderful job. She had wonderful children. She had a productive life. So far, I have none of those things. She had no criminal history. She had anti-criminal history. And so in cases like that, what it really comes down to is the case is about what can be imagined, and it's not about what actually exists. So in a lot of the cases that we work on, we're looking at people who are likely suspects. They have done things. They've done things that make them a likely suspect. She had nothing like that. And it's my hope that it's cases like this that will really drive home to people who have a voice in the community that things are broken and things have to be fixed. And the other thing that makes Beverly completely different from almost anyone I can imagine knowing is after having been through this, she's willing to go and talk to people about it and share what happened and entertain questions, which most people couldn't do, and I think a lot of people wouldn't do. So she's my hero and why I do this work, and have at her.
Thank you. Thank you, Deirdre. Thank you. Deirdre's right. I've had a horrible experience, something I never imagined. It was totally incomprehensible. And as an average citizen and 55 years old, daughter had just finished law school, another daughter in college at William & Mary, and a son who was at VCU. You have a really good life, and you just don't realize it can change from one day to the next. I want to talk about my experience, and I'll go into a little more detail because all of you know everything about the law, so you can analyze these things for yourself, and if you have any questions, of course, fire away. It's already up here. I'm going to talk about justice and freedom. It's something I took for granted. It's very, well, politically conservative. I never thought about what happened to people. If I saw something in the paper about someone being arrested or suspected of something, I assumed, if I thought about it at all, I assumed they must have done something. The police must have something. I've learned that you could be targeted, any one of you in this room, a sister, a brother, a daughter, anyone, even, I've even seen in Virginia, 89-year-old woman who was accused and taken through a terrible ordeal for allegedly killing her boyfriend because he was going to leave her. It seems impossible, but these things do happen, and once they start, they are very, very hard to stop. Let me see if I can punch the right button now. Not that one. Okay. I'm one of very few females who are called exonerees, and I'm sure the prosecutor would not even admit that they won't admit that they're wrong. So it's a term that isn't used that often. But women, I was out at the national conference in Houston in spring. There were two other women there who had been exonerated. The reason is DNA. And DNA has, that's the wrong figure. That's, this slide is maybe 4 or 5 months old, and it's now 242. But I want you to think about the fact that those are only DNA exonerations. And I can't think of a single female that has been exonerated through DNA. Most of these are very violent murder, rape cases. So if the DNA gets tested, if it's available, it's a male, which is wonderful that these men have been exonerated. However, it leaves out not only most women, and there are many terrible cases of innocent women in prison, it leaves out about 95% of all of the other convictions that don't have DNA. And it's one of the things the public doesn't see, it doesn't register with the public. And the DNA exonerees are the fortunate ones, but I don't think anyone realizes how much work it takes. Many states now always did resist DNA testing. They throw up barriers to even producing the evidence, much less allowing, even if the innocent person or the defendant wants to pay for it or their family wants to pay for it, it simply doesn't happen. And I know of cases like that in Virginia and all over the country. And it's a funny backlash, actually a very tragic backlash, that some states have resisted more or actually refused to allow DNA testing simply because so many exonerations. You'd think it would be the other way around, but it's not. So we have the tip of the iceberg, and that estimate is about 5 to 10%. And some people extrapolate from that figure to maybe 10,000 or more, some say tens of thousands of people out of the entire population of convicted people in prison. I don't know. I can tell you that for the last 15, 20 years, I have studied cases and read cases, and in all of them, I'm appalled at the facts that were overlooked by the police, the facts that were withheld by the police and prosecutors, the mistakes and the errors and the outright fraud that has been done by forensic departments. I have a scientific background. I didn't know anything about forensics, but almost anyone, I think, can analyze scientific information just based on general facts. It doesn't happen. These are the factors that have been identified by the Innocent Project at Cardozo. Eyewitness identification, I think, takes about 65 to 75%. That's found in exonerations and cases that have been overturned. False confessions is a tough one. I'll come back to that one. Unreliable forensic science and crime lab fraud. That's the one that really gets to me, and I'll talk about that. Snitch testimony is, I'm sure you're familiar with that. It comes in several forms where someone in jail actually contacts the prosecutor. It also takes the other form in which police and prosecutors go to someone in jail who has had no contact with anybody and offers a deal and feeds them the details to make it viable. That involves prosecutor misconduct and police misconduct, but I think that category covers mostly withheld evidence and evidence that simply isn't disclosed or destroyed. Police perjury and influencing witnesses, both of those are I don't know a percentage, but you see it in almost every case. Ineffective or negligent defense counsel, that's a big one. And jury misconduct. I can tell you out of those eight, and there are two more, nine of those vectors were in my case, were used in my case, or what my conviction was based on. So I used to assume all of these things that I heard about justice. Reasonable doubt is, because innocent until proven guilty is just, it simply doesn't exist. Reasonable doubt in most cases just simply doesn't exist. It depends on what kind of jury you get, what kind of judge you get. I don't know what else. Fair trial. I don't think there is such a thing. In many ways, what I went through felt like a medieval process where you didn't believe this could be happening to you, and people were saying things you knew were absolutely untrue, and you didn't think that was possible in the courtroom. It was a circus. You think that prosecutors are supposed to present the facts. Not so. They will say anything that will win the case. Whether they're allowed to do that is another matter. That money to hire a good lawyer will not only clear you, get you off. I don't mind telling you, I spent $200,000 on an attorney. And then another $100,000 on an appeal attorney. And many thousands more. So it isn't about what your resources are, or how much money you have, or how much you can pay an attorney. It just simply isn't true. And I think the last one is the one that most people have no clue about, that an appeal will allow you to bring evidence. It won't. If you remember the pyramid with the little tip at the top, if you're doing an appeal, you're going through a very narrow process all the way up to the, when you get up to the, say, the Virginia Supreme Court, they're only listening to one small part. They may read the record or they may not, and it may make no difference. So your chances on an appeal are virtually nil. This tells you a little bit about what I thought about the police and justice. Truly, I grew up in a very, very small area in South Carolina a long time ago. And, you know, you thought of the police as your friends and the people who are there to protect you. It would never occur to you that anyone would do anything devious and if they made a mistake, they'd certainly straighten it out. I was extremely naive, and I take all the blame for that. This was Christmas, about 2 months before my friend's death. I had known him for about 13 years. He was an interesting person, a very intelligent person, complicated person. One of the things I didn't realize about him was that he had not only depression, which I did sort of think, but bipolar disorder. And even today, people don't talk much about mental illnesses or understand it. But bipolar disorder is a very, very serious mental problem, and it often leads to suicide for one reason or another. And here we were. These are my three kids, and at my home at Christmas, and we didn't know that life was going to change irrevocably. March the 4th. My friend's name was Roger. He was Polish. He was quite different, and his death was considered high profile. He was an art collector. He had a large place. I had my own life. I had my own career, my own home, and I was very independent, but that doesn't seem to make any difference to anyone. That I was there that evening and just doing the usual things. I had to get home early. I went to the Safeway to pick up some things. I actually got some things that he needed because he lived way out on the James River. And so what you'd think would be a normal evening. Came home, went to bed. I couldn't get him on the telephone. The line was busy. I always call because it was about 15 miles from my house out there and very twisty, dark road, so he'd always want to know that I got home safely. Now, these are some things that we didn't know. we found out much later that someone was at the home after I left. I left about 9:30. I thought I went to get gas, went to the grocery store. We also didn't know that a car was seen speeding out of the driveway. It was a very long, about half a mile driveway out to 522. I learned later that he had made a phone call after I left to a friend of his who was a book publisher. And his name was Don Bevel. Don told me about the call later. He said it was so strange. He had written it down on a Texaco bill that he had there. He'd never heard Roger sound like that. So these things, among other things, established the time of death at approximately 10:35. The next day, and forgive me if I have a little trouble with this, he was found there and on his own couch in his library, and his own gun there. And I don't remember a lot about that morning. The local police came in. I didn't see them. And the medical examiner, and I heard some of that from another part of the house. A lot of people were there. And the local police officer said he would talk to people early that afternoon, which he did. And I don't remember a lot about that except that I was kind of shattered, just shattered. And they told us it was a suicide. Nobody closed off the house or anything else. I didn't know anything about gunshot residue or what they were supposed to do. Nobody thought about things like that. We didn't know this until much later. There was a state police agent who, as I found later, attached himself to what he called high-profile cases. He had, we learned months later, called the local police. This was in Powhatan. And then he later said, later testified, he already knew in his mind that it would be a murder. He did absolutely nothing. Still didn't go to the house, still didn't preserve anything. And I realized later that's because evidence gets in the way. And he also admitted, we actually found his notes eventually, that he already had a theory. Now, this, I have to give you a bit of history. Deirdre asked me about State Police Agent David Riley. I did some research once I was able to. He had been involved in several cases, and at least four or five of those had ended up with him being, if not in big trouble, at least reprimanded or accused of perjury, obstruction of justice, fabrication of evidence, and intimidation of witnesses. And in this particular case, which was the Emerson Stevens case, the defense attorney in that case filed a formal complaint to the Attorney General's office stating just those facts and documenting them in about a four-page letter. The FBI was involved, and nothing ever happened. And I can't absolutely prove it, but at that point in 1987, he transferred to Richmond, which is why he was there when this happened. He'd also in the interim gotten involved in another case in Lancaster County in which he was caught doing something similar. And that case was reversed by Judge Benton. The theory, it was always one of my favorite quotes by Einstein, I first saw it when I was in grad school. The theory determines what can be observed, and you'll see it. It's the basic tenet of science, but also of anything else that you want to learn. If you start out with a theory and you only look at what supports that, you don't really have the truth and you don't have the facts. So, and again, we learned all of this later. I knew nothing about what was going on. I was just grieving. We got through the funeral. I was trying to get back to work. And this was that nobody else ever said anything about Roger having any problems. Nobody else ever mentioned suicide. And, you know, I didn't know this is what he was doing, but that was basically what he started out as the Erie's case, of course, we eventually found all kinds of things that had already contradicted him. We did learn 7 years later that within 4 days, he had met with forensic people at the state lab before any test had been conducted, except the autopsy, which did all of those reports, were labeled suicide. We never saw those until much, much later, but they were. But those six people from the forensic lab and the local person, and they had already concluded it was murder, and I was the suspect. I had no clue, no way of knowing. His investigation, and this was from a deposition in federal court, 8 years, 8, 9 years later, was reading up on classical music and art so he could have some kind of way to talk to me. And he also went to the farm, talked to the farm manager, who was the person who had been first in the room, and it turns out that that farm manager had picked up the gun without thinking and put it back, as he said, where he thought it was. Well, the reason that was important was that the idea was to make it look like the suicide was staged. These were their very words. So that man changed his story between March and the trial. Said he couldn't remember. I don't know exactly why. He was a nice man. I don't know. I just can tell you that these things happen. The other part of his strategy in his investigation was making sure we knew nothing was going on. The person who received the phone call threw the notes away. He didn't know there was an investigation. They had hidden the local medical examiner's conclusion that was suicide, had been called in. All the internal lab reports, Roger's ex-wife, who was a doctor, had called and said he was supposed to be taking antidepressant medicine. I didn't even know that. Initial statements from at least 8 people who verified everything that I said about the problems. Some of these people also changed their stories by trial. And all of the physical evidence from the home. We also didn't know that that first day the local person had taken what's called a GSR kit. And when that conclusion was made, those tests had not been run. They waited about 2.5 weeks, and it came back heavily positive for Roger firing the gun himself. We didn't see this for 5 years. So I want to correct one thing, that this wasn't just one state police agent. And that's the part I find most troubling about all of this is that, and in every case, at some point, there are many people involved who see these things, see the evidence, and see that it's not being observed or used. And those people could stop it. At the lab, at the local, his supervisor, anybody who knows about this, not one single person said stop. They all went along with it. So it's not just one bad apple that causes these things to happen. Some other things I didn't know. May 4th, there was a woman who had a long criminal history, an African-American woman, long criminal history, and known by most people in the prisons as a pathological liar, but she was also smart enough to know how to get out of trouble. It turns out that she had skipped bond, gone to California, committed more crimes, and been extradited back to Virginia. But it also turned out, which none of us had any clue, and we didn't know this either, we didn't know who she was. She had a prior history with the same state police agent, collaborating on cases years prior to this, in more than one occasion. And I'll tell you kind of how I found that out later. It was not easy. She was facing a lot of time and looking for a way out. She contacted the FBI, and she contacted the state police agent, we think. It could be the other way around, but those two got together. And she was looking for a deal. Now, this was all happening from May through the trial and after the trial. The story that she was supposed to have, or that they relied on, was that in the spring of 1991, I went bonkers And the prosecutor actually used those words. I went bonkers. And Roger was seeing someone else, actually several people. He was, he had, I think, multiple personalities. He was a wonderful person, but he had a flawed mental condition. And so that if I knew this, I was just going to go bonkers. Well, of course, I knew that already, and I wasn't bonkers. In fact, in the spring of 1991, we were in Poland, and he took this picture, Roger took this picture. And it was at the time that this, I was supposed to have met this woman, this felon, and who was supposed to sell me an untraceable gun. Now, what that had to do with his death, there was no connection, really, but it was to make me out to be the character and to make the scenario of the murder. This would have been a year before Roger's death. On June 3rd, it was my mother's birthday. I was back at work. I was beginning to kind of, I think, recover. And I got a call. I did skip over one thing. I didn't have a slide on that. On March 26th, March 23rd, the police agent had called me and said they wanted to talk to everybody again, and they had said that in the beginning. And so he had called me at work and said, you meet him out at Roger's house. I didn't have any idea that this was a setup. He said he wanted to talk to me because I was the person closest to Roger, and he said he was filling out a suicide report. I was a basket case. I was there all day. I had nothing to eat. I had anything to eat for days. Not much sleep. And I had no idea what was going on. But later when I looked back at it, he would ask questions that weren't true. He would say things that weren't true. And then if I said, I don't remember that, he'd say, it's okay, you're traumatized. Your memory really isn't good when you're in this kind of condition. He said, I understand. He told me his father had committed suicide. My father had committed suicide. And that was extremely hard. I know that at the time I was talking about my father's death and Roger's death. And what I didn't realize for years until I looked back at all of these notes was, and listened, he was taking what I said about my father's death and intermingling with Roger's death to make it appear that I was there that night as opposed to left that night. I did leave, of course. So he was mixing the facts from the morning after Roger's death, but the night before and between my father's deaths. It's so complicated. And until you see it, it's diabolical. But that's what was happening that day. He was trying to convince me that my memory was not right, that I had blacked out. I'm sure you've seen this in other cases. And that I must be repressing some memory. And that memory was supposed to have been that I must have been there, asleep that night, and heard the gun go off. Now, he got that from the fact that my mother heard the gun go off. That's where it came from. So this is what Deirdre talks about as the so-called confession. He claimed that one time during that late afternoon, when he had forgotten to turn the tape off, I didn't even know there was a tape, that I had told him that I was there asleep on the couch. Wasn't true, because the rest of the tape shows that I didn't know what he was talking about. I remembered leaving Roger at the door. So, I mean, the facts disputed all of that. However, that's where it went. Deirdre asked me about Riley. I know that tunnel vision occurs. I know that police and prosecutors can be overzealous. And I know that a lot of misconduct occurs. I saw it. But I still cannot explain how this case, or a lot of the cases that I see, are allowed to proceed. But they do. And once that train starts, nobody stops it, no matter how egregious or how obvious it is. So on June the 3rd, I'm going to skip over this one. I'll come back to it. On June the 3rd, He called me at work and said he just wanted to wrap up the suicide report. Would I meet him somewhere? And I didn't think of a place. I was busy. And he said, oh, meet me at this park. It was a very Civil War park down below Richmond. So sure enough, I'm so dutiful, and I would never think to say, no, I'm not going to talk to you. I told my secretary I'd be back, you know, in half an hour. It took an early lunch. I was down there at 11. Got in my car. There's nobody around. Woods. He kept me there for 5.5 hours. He threatened all kinds of things, including things against my children, my job. He said, your life is going to be over. He said, you never lost a case. He said, I'll make you out. And these are exact words, to be the Black Widow Spider of all time. And I didn't know what to do. I knew I wasn't going to get away from him. I thought I could talk to the prosecutor. I said, you know, this is all wrong. And I said, I have a receipt from the store. You know, I know where I was. He said, receipts don't mean anything. He later testified it was his job to undermine that receipt. I did have a receipt. I had a receipt, a check for going to the store. I kept all of those things. I had receipts and checks going back for 20 years. But it didn't matter. And so he literally said, it's either you or he wrote out what he called a hypothetical statement about being asleep on the couch. And he said, you know, if I didn't sign it, he was going to arrest me right then, and my life would be down the drain. I knew I'd lose my job. I was a mainstay for my kids. I mean, I couldn't imagine. And later, the hypothetical part disappeared. This was on an 11 by 14 legal pad in pencil. And he had written hypothetical across the top. That all disappeared, of course. And it was his word against mine. He later claimed he couldn't, he didn't have time to get a recording or anything else. It turns out that the prosecutor had set this up. They'd worked together. And he had offered me all kinds of pleas, like Alford plea. I had no idea what that was. But I kept saying, you know, it's not true. And I couldn't imagine. And what I did was, that was the only evidence that they had. That's it. So, I had to call my daughter, who was clerking, well, she was just out of law school, clerking for a judge here in Charlottesville. And I still didn't seem to understand at that point just how dreadful it was. I thought, well, I'll get it straightened out. Because, you know, I went back to work, and I realized everybody was gone. I didn't even think about what to do. I called Katie, and she said, oh, my gosh, you know. And so she called a friend, and said, no, it was just like everything was haywire from then on. That summer, we decided we'd just get through this somehow and get it all straight. And we really believed in the system. We thought we would. Not the way it is. 2 weeks before trial, I'm asked if I know this woman whose name is Smith. I don't, of course. She's in the Chesterfield jail. The Chesterfield prosecutor has now joined in my prosecution. I realize later he's there to reward her because he's in a different jurisdiction. So we come to the trial, and there are really two things that they have to prove. One is whether it's a suicide or a murder. The other was whether I was there or not. And so even though they put on 4 days of forensic fraud, the three state experts, when they were asked, they could not exclude suicide. That should have been the first threshold. Didn't matter. The second claim was that I had to be there at 10:35. Well, I had a receipt from 15 miles away in the supermarket at 10:40 checking out. And then it turns out that the state police agent had actually gone and rummaged around in the trash cans at the Safeway to see if he could come up with a receipt that he could somehow claim that that's how I got it. You know? But I had to check to match. So in addition to that, as the trial started, a man I talked to in the store that night, just by chance, a construction worker, came forward and testified. that he saw me. He knew what we talked about. He knew what I had on me. And he knew what time he was there. He had it on his calendar because he knew why he was in Richmond. So, in closing arguments, the prosecutor stood up and said, forget about that receipt. That witness, you know, that doesn't matter to a roll of pens, whatever that is. And he said, she could have come back some other time. She could have come back some other time. That was it. And then, you know, in spite of everything that we didn't know, we still had proved that they hadn't proven their case, but we had proved everything that they'd said was wrong. The Commonwealth witnesses corroborated me. I mean, there was nothing except this woman from the jail who claimed I tried to buy a gun from her in the cemetery in my beige trench coat. And so I can't imagine anybody could believe it, but we had discredited her. I'm in this courtroom with my children, their friends. My mother's there with her oxygen tank, my three brothers, my colleagues from work. And I say, guilty. And I'll never forget the look on the judge's face. It was so horrible. I remember Katie screaming. And my kid's arms around me, and about, I don't know how many minutes later, things kind of died down, and I got my wits about me, and I said, well, what do I have to do? And it was like, well, you know, we don't know. We can go home. Literally. And I thought about that later, and what it meant to me was, as I looked through all of this and realized, because I thought it was all a big mistake, you know, at that time I didn't really know, that they knew there was no murder. They knew I was innocent. It didn't matter to them anymore that they'd gotten the win. I mean, I still had my passport. I had friends who wanted me to get out of this country, and I couldn't understand. So I went home, and I remember sitting by the fire, and what do we do now? And we just sat and held hands, and about a Wednesday or so, that was Monday, I got a call from my attorney. He said, they made a mistake. You know, you have to, if you're convicted of first-degree murder, you have to go to prison. So I had 2 days to wrap up my life. I had some properties, investment, career, house, cars, you know, all of his kids in college. And my kids packed me a little cardboard box with my socks and undies and things and drove me out to the prison. And they'd forgotten I was coming at the local place. Yeah. The local place. I was worried. We had breakfast that morning. Kids laughed about me, and I was so worried about being late. They give me a hard time about that yet. But we went out there, and just like, you know, And so they drove me, and so then the guy had to get in the deputy's car, and he was very apologetic. And the kids followed me over to prison. And I won't talk much about that experience because it's another whole dreadful ordeal. But again, you just think you're in a surreal world, as we were as of June 3rd. And so you just think, I've got to get through this somehow. And you do. You just do. Here was the first flower. Katie got organized. But, you know, still we thought the process of appeal would have some meaning. Katie got organized. We used this as the flyer for a number of reasons, but primarily because it disproved their case. I couldn't have been, and their star witness. I spent 6 months, three of that in a real 5x9 concrete box. I think had I not had someone outside, like Katie and my daughter and friends, it would have been a lot worse. I know it would have been. But after 6 months, after letting me go home, no strings attached whatsoever, then they didn't even want to give me an appeal bond. Because they don't give you, you have to pay for it. It's very expensive, and you have to have surety for it. But still, it allows you to be out. And I realize now it's because they knew how determined we would be, and I think they thought we would investigate, and it was to keep us off balance. I didn't even have contact with the kids a lot of that time. But I got the appeal bond done. It's a considerable cost. The appeals court had to force the judge to give me an bond, even though we met all the conditions. And that took the 6 months. Then I had about 2.5 years to fight the appeal. And meanwhile, I lost my job. I was still trying to hang on to my home and investigating, because I could not imagine where this star witness had come from. And I had no, I didn't even suspect anything about the police or even the prosecutors until I started reading and analyzing. That was my, what they call mugshot. And it says, a seemingly cheerful Monroe is proud of her children. Well, I was proud of my children, but that's not why I was smiling. You know, you just, you don't know what else to do. And I do smile a lot, and it gives you strength. It really does. And you see when you're in a place like that, that there's so many people who are just in dreadful shape, just in terrible shape. And so you feel fortunate, really. And you see a lot of people who need help. So, yes, I did smile. I was in prison a lot. Legal battle was very, very difficult and very expensive. In January of 1996, after investigating and putting together, we had 11 claims that were really good claims. That several of the hearings had gone very well. The state had been caught in misstating the record, for example. Right after Christmas of 1995, the opinion came down. It's just rubber stamp that the death occurred at 10:35. No mention of the receipt. That the witness was believable, credible. The only credible witnesses were the state police agent and this woman. So I had to go back to prison, and that was really tough. I knew I'd lose my house then. I didn't know how the kids were going to manage. And so we thought, we don't know how long it would take us to get a writ of habeas going. Katie was already searching for an attorney. I was out of liquid assets pretty much at that time, other than selling the house. And I didn't have any time. You know, I had to go right back. In April, all of you are familiar with the ADPA, I hope. Huge change in the law for the writ of habeas and standards, so-called standards of innocence. We didn't even know. I read about it in Time magazine while I was sitting in the prison waiting to go somewhere. By that time, the media had, I say the media in general, but several people in the media had begun to take notice of this case, and they were beginning to ask questions. So I think that was a turning point, but it was very, very tough. And the only way you get through something like this is to say, I'm going to do my best, win or lose. You just have to. That was us at Christmas, right before I had to go back. We're still like that. In 1998, this is Katie's really beginning to gear up because she had to be the point person on this. We couldn't find a pro bono attorney. We had someone I was paying as a consultant, Don Lee, and Alfred Brown, whom probably some of you know. And Alfred's just a jewel. And they were just helping because they believed in it. And Katie went to the first, and Asher, who was 4 months old, my grandson, went to the first national a conference on innocence in Chicago, and they attracted a lot of attention. And a group out of Canada did a show called Justice Denied. Very, very agonizing to have these media things done about your life. You know, you've gone through all of your life, and you have never even had a parking ticket. I would have been mortified to have a parking ticket. And then suddenly, your whole life is defined by this bizarre, horrible things and all these things that people are saying about you. You have to kind of be impervious to it. You can't. It's agonizing. It's agonizing for the kids. And I sure was our one joy through that entire thing. But as you can see, the family was always there. Every time the doors of the prison opened, they were there, ice, snow, whatever. And it wasn't just for my benefit. There were so many women who didn't have anybody that visited them. They got this tremendous vicarious pleasure out of seeing my family there and also believing in the case. I had so much help from the women in prison. I could stand and talk for hours about how good that was, and even some of the officials there. November 1999, the attorney that was helping us had developed cancer. But it was also the beginning of hope for us. We got discovery in federal court. I'd been working all of this time, I mean, sometimes till 2, 3 in the morning, and working a job at teaching at prison. And discovery simply means, I'm sure you have the textbook version of it, but it means you get what's filtered down, whatever is left, say the Agent Riley's notes, that filters through him and then filters through the State Attorney General's office, and it's narrowed to the claims, and I'm sure a lot is held back. In fact, I would hold them these pages up to the light, and you didn't have much light in the prison, and you could see where and they had a Xerox machine that would pick up from something that had already been on there, but you didn't have that piece. I could read and see parts of documents that I didn't have that were pertinent to this woman's history, to all kinds of things. So you know you didn't get everything, but we got a lot, and most of it did support, in fact, all of it supported our claims, but some of it was very important, like the medical examiner's initial conclusion to suicide, for example. Now, the sad part is you have to wait, or you don't have to wait, you have to fight for 9, 10, 15, 20, 25 years to get the documents that should have been there in the beginning for you. But the problem with it is, and it took me a long time to understand this, is if the truth had mattered in the beginning, this would never have happened. It could not. And it's a very, very sad thing to have to say, after spending most of my life thinking I could depend on the system. We had a lot of setbacks, though. The discovery was great. The depositions were Don Lee, I don't know, Deirdre, if you remember Don, just fabulous. He just nailed them to the wall. He was sick. He had pneumonia. He was doing depositions. He had his arm amputated from the cancer. And he didn't miss a beat, and it was extremely important. We went to the original judge, Judge Williams, who had ordered the discovery. I went on a sabbatical or something. He transferred it over to a magistrate judge who denied after a very expensive and positive evidentiary hearing. Just denied. Fortunately, it was only a recommendation. And when Judge Williams got it back, I remember him saying later he would never, ever give any case of importance to this magistrate again. He was adamant about it. So the first hope I had was seeing in something, one of the hearings, I wasn't allowed to go to the hearings. In one of the hearings, I got the transcript, and Judge Williams had said when the State Assistant Attorney General was misquoting the record about Agent Riley and the so-called statement, and he stopped him, right? In essence, said, don't even go there. He said, I know the police erase these tapes so they can fill in the lies they need. And I thought, nobody's ever used the L word. And there it is. And that was really the first hope I had, that maybe somebody really sees. March 28, 2002, as you can see, he didn't remand it. He overturned and vacated the convictions. And he called it egregious and a monument to mishandling and indiscretion. That's putting it mildly. But at least we thought you know, that was the first ray of hope we'd had. And the state of Virginia didn't know what to do. They didn't know, there was no procedure for releasing me. And, I mean, everybody at the prison was, they were just going nuts. They were just, they couldn't hold themselves together. They thought Kay and Katie came, they would just cheer. So they kept coming, and I was there a whole week before they released me, and the state tried to prevent my release, saying it was for the safety of the Virginia public. And, no, seriously, and then I remember from one hearing they had with Judge Williams, they tried to say I hadn't been rehabilitated. he was not happy, and so eventually I was released, and if I can get this one to come up, it kind of came about in rapid fire once it got started. And I remember I was in this big, they called it a dorm, it's more like a concrete warehouse, and sometimes there were as many as 80 women in there, double bunked, 3 feet apart, and they were all at the windows. And when Steve, this is Steve Northrup, who was by that time our lead attorney. Steve was a civil attorney, but he had come on the case when Don Lee was working. Don died of the cancer in about 2000, I think. And it took us a while to recover from that. In fact, we haven't recovered from that. But Steve took over, and Katie was essentially the attorney, but Steve was a point attorney. Troutman Sanderson was a huge help. So, when Steve came, I mean, the women went absolutely wild. They were trying to go through the windows, and they were screaming, "Steve, Steve!" I don't know how they even knew his name. He was in the parking lot, you know, out there. So then when Katie and Janet showed up, they just, I thought they were going to get tickets. They could not hold them down. They were climbing up the bars and out the windows and everything. And it was a wonderful thing, because it wasn't about us. It was about winning where there had been no hope, and setting the record straight, and in a sense beating the system, because most of these women, even the ones who were guilty, had had things done to them which were not right. And so everybody understood, and that was the wonderful part. That's when the gates opening, and you don't believe it till you're outside that razor wire fence. The first time I've been able to hold my children without some guard saying that's long enough. That's Andy. Katie's Andy, who was a tremendous help. Andy was out getting affidavits. I didn't realize the media was there, and that's Asher. He's the only one who really knew his meeting was coming home. And that's at his birthday party at Katie's house. He's feeding me cake. He talks about it now. He said, "Wasn't that a wonderful day, meeting when you came home?" Well, the relief was brief. It really was. They just immediately appealed. And then you knew you're in for another long battle with the Fourth Circuit. And the Fourth Circuit is not known for overturning cases or worrying about innocence. I really, they're not. But I think in this case, something happened that was a little different. we spent about, let's see, close to a year preparing for that. And my mother died 4 months after I was released. I still wasn't allowed to go anywhere. I had to get some permission. Of course, Judge Williams said I didn't have any bond, zero. When I'd gone down to the courthouse after being released, even the marshals and the clerks in the federal courthouse were giving me the thumbs up sign. You'd go down the street and people would honk their horns and say, you know, it was just amazing. I didn't even know how they knew. But It was overwhelming, but we had this hearing in Richmond, and a friend took this picture afterwards. We were not happy. It was awful. It was terrible. The prosecutor said all kinds of horrible things about me and Katie. Yeah. It was just awful. And we thought, no, we don't have a prayer. But 3 months later, we got a call. I heard Katie screaming upstairs. I thought something awful had happened. And she couldn't talk. And so it was a unanimous decision to uphold Judge Williams. And then that same day, the Attorney General's office, Jerry Kilgore, dropped the appeal. I would think I wouldn't be standing here today if he hadn't. I can't say it was out of any altruistic motives, but he certainly did the right thing. He was running for governor, and this was getting to be a hot potato. Well, that summer before this hearing, friends, and I'll show you who they are in just a minute, had really been on the street corners getting people to sign petitions, and had my picture. It's hard enough to get somebody to sign a petition about breast cancer or anything else. If you try to get somebody to sign a petition saying the state has wrongfully convicted somebody, you don't even know that person, and you're somebody standing on the street corner with a petition, it's very difficult. But we learned later that actually someone from the AG's office signed it. He may have used a false name, I don't know, but he signed it. So we had over 3,000 signatures in a matter of about 2 months, and a petition that we took to the Attorney General's office, I say we, friends did, and asked, really to be able to sit down and talk to them about it, because I think as a citizen, as a taxpayer, I have the right, whether it's my case or somebody else's case, to sit down and talk to these people. They work for us. Am I wrong? But you can't do that. We got to talk to a deputy, two of our people, and we know they got the list of petitions. So I do think it's important. Again, not because it's about us, but because the system is so closed. And that's how these things can go on without oversight. It's a process that goes on its own volition, and nobody ever says, wait. So this was our first victory hug. This is Shannon there with all of us. You see, we couldn't stop smiling now. And that's our victory party. That was July 13th. As close to the Bastille Day as I could get. Out at Steve's house. There were about 250 people there. It was just wonderful. And after that, I jumped in my old car and headed out of Virginia. not to stay, but to see the people who have been so supportive. There were friends from graduate school, from the 1960, friends I hadn't seen or heard from in 40-some years, who came to our aid in droves. There were friends from high school in South Carolina from the 50s, friends from way back, even before that, all of my mother's friends, people we didn't even know who were emailing the Attorney General's office and said, why don't you do the right thing? And people from people abroad. So, again, I wouldn't be standing here if it weren't for those people and the people like you who care about justice, the people like Deirdre. I would read about them, and I had a trunk in prison, and most of it was legal files. Everybody else had potato chips and clothes and stuff. And every time they'd do a shakedown, they'd open it and they'd say, oh my God, what is this? And they'd have to sort through all those papers and files. Had a whole trunk full of them. But, I worked very, very hard while I was in there. And recovery is a whole new subject that I have. That trip was wonderful, to thank the people and to see the people and to just say, because nobody knows how difficult it is. You can't just pick up the phone and call the AG's office. You should be able to. There were times when some of my friends were afraid. They were afraid that something might happen to them. There were a couple of incidents which made us worry about standing up for justice. But we have recovered to a large degree. It is very, very difficult when you come out at any age. I saw men who had been in prison 38 years. They seem fine. But where do they go for work? Where do they go for medical treatment? I mean, we've lost everything. Most people who've been in since they were 20, they never had a chance to develop a life. That's where I was fortunate. So it is extremely difficult. Even though I had great work experience, A-plus record and everything else, I couldn't get a job. Nobody really wants to hire you first if you're over 65, and then when you have to tell them this story, you just don't fit. I told Deirdre, you can't be normal again. Dick said, they want to go to a football game. You know, football games, I used to think, were really lots of fun. They seem trivial now, and that's not to denigrate football. It's a great sport. But when there are people out there that need saving, and there's so much wrong with the system that allowed this to happen, you feel pressured all the time to do something. It's like being in prison still. You feel like you have to be working constantly. If you're not padding, you're not doing something, you're not researching, you're not trying to help somebody, it'll never happen. And you don't want it to happen to other people. And once this victory came down, we had people come to us, families that come to us for help. They thought we had the secret formula. There is no secret formula. That's Katie. And I finally got to D.C., and Andy took that picture. Katie had always threatened that if this case if we didn't win, she was going to climb the flagpole of the White House naked and stay there until somebody did something right. And fortunately, she didn't have to do that. So recovery, see, again, I'm lucky. We were able to go places and went out to Sundance. There's a wonderful film that you should see, not a wonderful film, a heart-wrenching, mind-wrenching film called After Innocence that you should see. It's all about DNA innocence, but you get to see what you're up against. I don't know whether you plan to be attorneys, whether you plan to be defense or prosecutors. We need more good prosecutors. But if you see that film, it will change the way you think about law, about justice, and about this legal process. When I was there for the opening in Sundance, everybody was in tears. The entire audience was in tears. And one young woman stood up and she said, "I'm a prosecutor." And she was bawling. And she said, "I want to apologize for every prosecutor in this country. I didn't know things were like this." And that was just from that one film. So there is an effort now to get that film to judges and in law schools. It's available on Netflix. So what we do now, abnormal though it may be, is to talk about this experience, not because it happened to us. We're the lucky ones. And to try to work with law enforcement. You know, there are a lot of good people in law enforcement. I know some of them. And I know some of them who left law enforcement because of what they saw and helped innocent people. But we have a common goal here, and that's to get justice and get to the truth. If you don't get the real perpetrator, and in my case there was no perpetrator, but in most there are people that need to be removed from committing more crimes. And that's what all of these DNA cases have shown. But in most cases, the prosecution doesn't seem to be interested in even going or going after the person or entering the DNA in a system to try to find out who the real perpetrator is. I've seen that time and time again. That doesn't make sense. All of us win when justice is served. And it has to be reliable, accurate justice and accountability, even for mistakes. And one of the things that hasn't happened is analyzing these cases and saying, what went wrong? But then the second step, what can we do about it? And all of these are preventable. I think even when there are mistakes, they're preventable at some point if not from conviction, which I think most are, they are preventable somewhere down the line. You're able to stop them if everybody has the same goal in mind. And that's why we have to work with law enforcement. It's also extremely costly. The cost of wrongful convictions is just untold, and losses to families, and just out. You know, it costs millions to do this, to convict me. Why? And that's an important question. I've learned never to assume guilt. I don't necessarily believe the story that person is telling me. I try to look at the facts. You need to get all the facts that are available and then look for what really might be out there. So I know some of you are doing some investigation. Don't hesitate to speak out. Write a letter, call, email. Exercise civic duty as well as your legal experience and be involved. This is what I call my little band of brave hearts. That's Katie, of course, on the left. Behind her is her high school friend, Tanya, who worked for a short while in the Forensics Department. She wanted to be a doctor. That discouraged her. She saw so much misconduct, it discouraged her from going on with that career. She's now is in science. She was our forensic person. So I called her my blonde Viking daughter. Next to her is someone I didn't know, a friend of my daughter's, just got on board and helped organize. That's me with a very short haircut in the center. Next to me is another person I didn't know, I call her my other daughter, Jody. She's the one who just would not let go, like a bulldog, on the this bunch of legislators, went to the AG's office, did everything. And that's my other daughter with her eyes closed. She was our media point person and every other kind of thing that needed doing that Katie didn't have time to handle. And behind her is Stephen, her husband. And Stephen and Andy's taking the picture. Andy was the one who went out and got affidavits. These are the ones who got the affidavits for the writ. Covered a lot of ground. Nobody had ever done that before. Made a huge difference. And shows you what you can do. Katie now heads up an innocence project in out west in Utah, Wyoming, and Nevada. She's gotten a lot of good publicity. I've been out there to speak with Dennis Fritz. I don't know if you know the book Grisham wrote about the innocent man. And various places we go. We went to Alaska this summer just to help fundraise. The network's growing. There are all kinds of resources. I put a few down here I'd like you to look at. I want to show you this one. This is the Culpepper case. If you hear anything about it, this young man's name is Michael Hash. He has an appeal before the Virginia Supreme Court waiting for the opinion. He has a life sentence. There's no doubt whatsoever from the facts that he's innocent. And Deirdre knows a lot about the background of that case. So if you just talk about these things, the general public doesn't have any clue. They wouldn't know the name. They wouldn't know the case is going on. And you can help involve people in supporting and encouraging justice through these cases. Let's see if I can find that other. What happened to our keyboard? I was going to pull the other one up on, but our keyboard is not here.
I think the slide's underneath.
It's hidden from me. Hidden evidence. Here, I'm not sure I know how to get it. I want to get out of that now. I just want to show you one more. I'm showing you this because this. Even though that's Katie over there, and this is the assistant AG out in Utah, and that's the governor signing a bill. And the bill is to address non-DNA evidence, which is a big, big issue that we need to push for now. But I'm showing it to you because Artie here is the student in the clinic who really initiated that and pursued it and made it happen. So it's to let you know I expect big things out of all of you. And in Virginia, toughest place of all, but you can do it. I know you can. Thank you very much. You've been very attentive. I appreciate it. Again, I do expect big things from you. Can you hear me? Yeah, she asked if I had a good relationship with my trial attorney. His name was Murray Janice. He was a very well-known attorney. He is still in Richmond. You know, I didn't know what to expect. And it took me... Well, the first thing he said was, write me a check for $50,000. Which I did. I was a saver, a squirrel. And so then he patted me on the hand, and he said, don't worry, you know, there's no evidence, and there's reasonable doubt all over the place. Well, you know, you just kind of turn your life over to someone. Then I realized about a month later, nothing had happened, and, you know, we didn't again know what was supposed to be happening. And Katie was worried, and so, yeah, to answer your question, that's why about a month before the trial, I hired another investigator, Katie knew. She was still clerking here in Charlottesville, and she knew an investigator, and paid them more money to come and investigate, and they really found a lot of things. But I do remember the day before the trial when we were supposed to be going over things. Murray had two TVs on, watching two football games at the same time. And, I mean, that was indicative of the lack of preparation. And I don't know. I think a lot of attorneys would do that and they walk in and expect to just blow everybody away. But in addition to that, there was a book written by John Taylor called The Count and the Confession. It was written before I was released and before we had any hope of release. And John did a good job, I think. I don't like the book, and I don't like any books about that. But he was very objective, and he went to my trial attorney and wanted to get some information from him about his perspective. And Murray told him a story that it was one of the few times in this entire time I just kind of lost heart. The trial, I remember at the trial, the judge saying, we've got to get this thing over with. He told it, you know, when he was making sound, I was like, this is taking too much time. And so my defense attorney told this author that right before the trial, my defense attorney met with the judge in Powhatan, and they wanted to go to the UVA football game the following Saturday, so that's why they had to get this thing over with. And it's kind of hard to be sitting in prison with your kids out working for you and know that. It was not a minor thing. It was indicative of the entire process. There were other things that were very specific, but no. I felt betrayed. And I had to, one of the reasons the appeal was so difficult was because so little had been done at trial to preserve. You're all familiar with the rule about preserving for appeal and objecting, and it wasn't done. Just even the forensic, you saw the slide with the forensic evidence. That report, the top of it, was slipped into the record, and they went through 4 days of truly bogus testimony and a so-called reconstruction. And if you have a few minutes, I'll tell you, because it's so mind-boggling. And then after all of that, the prosecutor from Chesterfield had a sheaf of papers like that thick, and he came up and said, just have a little housekeeping. It's like that kind of thing. He handed it to the judge, and the judge kind of flipped through it, and he said, like, don't you want to use this? That's all I remember. I had no idea what it was. My attorney It was the top of that forensic report that had the positive results for the GSR. Well, they had just presented a whole case that his hand couldn't have possibly been on the gun, and there was no GSR. That was the testimony from Dr. Marcella Fierro, who was head of the lab. Well, we didn't know to catch it, but my attorney should have done something. It took us 5 years. Another attorney from California, who happened to read, we just ran into him by, and he said he'd read through it. He said, how come nobody did anything about this? So that's the answer to your question, as best I can. Yeah. Yes.
Did anybody from your legal team interview with the jurors?
We tried. Everybody tried. Not the legal team. No, the legal team never tried. The investigator that I hired from Charlottesville, that's one of the first things they wanted to do. So they went to the jury pool. Do you know that? And they got some interesting information, but most people would not talk to them. And in fact, before the trial started, the prosecutor tried to bring some motion to implicate them in some kind of harassment of the jurors. So afterwards, my mother tried to call. They wouldn't talk to her. There were three women jurors, two of whom Katie saw, very upset, and one of them was crying. We don't know much. I can tell you what happened with the jury from what I know. Trial was over. They took 2 hours to come back with a verdict. During that time, they ate their lunch, had it delivered, and then ate their lunch. Within 1 hour, they had come back to ask what the meaning of premeditation was. There were 155 paper, evidence, all kinds of stuff. All of it in my favor, the real stuff. And they could not have booked it anything. We learned much later that one of the jurors had a theory, and he decided to demonstrate exactly how it was. I really can't blame the jurors. They should be able to rely on what the prosecution presents. And I can tell you that, as best I can explain it, I wish I had those slides. Their theory, the forensic theory that was literally manufactured, was that somehow they found it that right with my left hand, and I think they only saw it when I was taking notes in the courtroom. But I'm not left-handed. I do everything else right-handed. So anyway, that was the theory, that someone with the left hand reached down, and because he was found facing a very deep couch with a straight back, facing us, was really not much room for anybody to do that except him. And so, by leaning out the couch entirely, the ballistics person, firearms person at the state lab, concocted this theory that someone with the left hand somehow turned the gun upside down like this and reached down in there somehow. And in which case, as another attorney pointed out later, the bullet would have been going up, which was not the trajectory. But the idea was that he must have been asleep, and he sometimes slept like this. Well, they said he must have been asleep like this, and someone put the gun in between his ears. Well, it was all utterly impossible. So it was called the upside-down theory. And so when the ballistic firearms person was asked to demonstrate it, she couldn't pull the trigger that way. She tried three times. It didn't matter. So by leaving out the cast, leaving out the forensic evidence, all of the other things that mattered, she concocted this crazy theory. Well, and they flashed some pictures of her reconstruction. It was about the year before I was released. There was a woman in prison who worked for a firearms company somewhere over in this area. And she'd been kind of caught up in something. Somebody had been selling some illegal guns or something. She got caught up in that. So she said, let me see those pictures. And I said, okay. Well, she looked at it, and this is the reconstruction picture that was put at the trial for the proof that it couldn't be a suicide. It had to be a murder. And she said, wait a minute, she's using her right hand. In the reconstruction, she was using her right hand. But they told everybody in the trial, it's the left hand, upside down. It didn't matter. And we didn't even see it. We didn't see it because it didn't occur to us to say, wait a minute, they just fabricated everything, including the photograph. So, unfortunately, that's where you have to start when you investigate cases. You have to almost eliminate everything that comes from an official source and go back and make sure it's valid, including DNA testing. Am I not right?
No, you're right. It's horrible.
It is horrible. And it really wasn't until then when I started thinking that I really was able to put things together. When I say I, everybody else too, but when you're in prison and you every spare minute, you didn't have much, you're thinking, you know, how did this happen? What can I do? Are you going through this in your mind? And I remember when I was first in prison, the women, we had to mob at night. Not that it made any difference, you know, you've got 35 women in that small basement. And those women, who didn't even know me, I was working on my case, and they wouldn't let me take the turn at 11 o'clock. And they'd all be quiet. They said, Ms. Beverly's working on her case. I find that, it's very touching. But that's, again, how people who don't have to be involved can get involved and help. And it did help. In all kinds of ways. Yes?
I really believe they just let you go. They were like, what's the worst thing you can do? Get a pardon ticket? Which you've never had. Were you ever sentenced?
Yes, I'm sorry. I kind of skipped over that. I was sentenced in December after the trial. Trial was October. And after letting me go home, then they put me back. Then I went to prison. And then they didn't have the sentencing until December the 8th. And it was only after I'd gone back and looked at the files for this woman from Chesterfield jail. It was another whole experience. I didn't know you could do that. So I learned how to go to every jurisdiction because she had so many crimes, petty crimes, serious crimes, everything else in every jurisdiction around Richmond and even in Brunswick County and other places. So I was over there and... I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Were you sentenced?
Yes. The week after the trial, when I went to find her records, I came across a transcript, and I had to get it done. And they had had a secret hearing for her in judge's chambers in Chesterfield with the state police agent there, the prosecutor from Chesterfield. And nobody would have looked for it had I not gone to look for it. I actually put on a blonde wig one time because I was trying every way I could to get in there without them knowing who I was. And so I found that hearing was on December 7th. So they had postponed my sentencing till after that for some reason. And it was just all, she had filed for release, a motion to just release all of her from everything within a week of the trial. They had, of course, at trial, said she had absolutely no idea of any consideration. She was just a good citizen. She had a past, but you know, here she is doing the right thing. And she deliberated over that for two whole months. And she said later she was reading her Bible and trying to decide, talking to her pastor. And I'm serious, her exact words in federal court depositions. And that doesn't bother me. What bothers me is this assistant attorney general that I pay for. I pay his salary. Has his arm around her, saying she's the most truthful person. That bothers me. She could not have done this by herself.
Did anything happen to any of the people involved? Police,
no.
Prosecutors?
No. I got a threat from the prosecutor. I told Deirdre. And it was sort of to the effect that one of the exact words, I'd better lie low. Obviously, I'm not.
And you're not rehabilitated.
No, I'm not by the least. There are times I think I could. In fact, there were times I was walking around in that razor wire fence thinking, gee, I can understand how guerrilla warfare starts, really. You see so much wrong, and you think somebody has to do something. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't take a bulldozer and go right through the fence. But it crosses your mind. And you can understand how people will be very rational in saying, I have to do something no matter what it is.
I'm cutting her loose if you don't.
Okay, again, thanks to everybody. And get out there and, yeah, do some really good work. Help some innocent people, help some families, but most of all, help reform this process so that it works better. Thank you.